The TNT Shop has great gift ideas for your furry family member at TNTRadio.live. You're listening to The Alan Miller Show on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Very, very bright, cheery eyes. Good morning, America, East Coast. And if you're up on the West Coast, I'm impressed. Latin America, Asia. And of course, hello, everyone in Britain. I'm Alan Miller. What another week, and another week of revelations, of reports, of the Counter-Disinformation Unit. Just bear on that for a second. The Counter-Disinformation Unit, set up for terrorism, to challenge that, fair enough. We need to address those things, of course we do. Used then during COVID, attacking citizens, doctors, suppressing posts, talking to social media. 90% of posts were either deleted or suppressed. It was under the Department for Culture, Media and Sport. Let that sink in. It's not very cultural or sporty. Certainly not cricket, as one might have said in the past. But there we have it. And we've had a huge piece again on the Telegraph today in the United Kingdom talking about, now we know it's Sarah Connolly who was heading up that unit, as well as the all-party parliamentary group now having engaged with the Telegraph. And the Telegraph says, so the BBC has a reputation as a truth teller, but in COVID it did what the government wanted. In actual fact, if you get into the discussion about this, you get to see that many journalists had raised the issue. They were told not to talk about even lockdowns, not to raise questions, not to have any skepticism. What we saw was cheerleading and tub thumping, utterly unacceptable. The COVID situation was not just for that. We still have the Counter Disinformation Unit. It's now, believe it or not, yes, science at the Department for Science, Innovation and Technology. Can't make that up either. It needs to be disbanded, as David Davis has said. At Together, we certainly think that's the case as well. And we should have no spying on citizens. We should have free speech and open debate, which is what we have here at TNT Radio, everybody. Of course we do. We engage in debate and ideas and discussions, the virtues and the merits of those conversations, not having them shut down. We've got some great guests today. Before I bring my next one in, I also want to talk about some of the terrible things that are happening across the board, not just in the NHS with cancer patients and others. I had to take a relative in this week, and you see the hours that people have to wait in A&E, the pressure they're under. We have a situation where our infrastructure and our services are not operating properly. We need to get a grip with this. And whilst Labour wants to say, well, you can't blame lockdowns anymore, they wanted longer, harder lockdowns. The Tories are completely in crisis. We've seen the situation today with the PM. Seems that, and also with Boris Johnson going, seems that there are no serious people who are engaged with the public and citizens. And that's why those who are prepared to have courage and speak up and talk about issues, even at the risk of their names and reputations and careers, are so essential now. Giving a lead when others refuse to or abdicate the responsibility, that might be teachers, it might be union leaders, it might be people in the medical profession or politicians who abdicate their positions. One person who has had courage, that many of you will be familiar with, is joining us now very kindly from Tel Aviv in Israel. He is Dr. Eli David, who, Eli David, many of you will see in some of his criticisms on social media ongoing. He's a leading AI expert, as well as specializing in deep learning and evolutionary computation, which I know for some people they get very concerned about. What does it all mean in the conversations with Elon Musk? I'm looking forward to getting into some of this with Eli. And he's also on the board of universities. He's been nominated as one of the key people on Twitter alongside Elon Musk. And he's definitely become a reference point for those that are critical and asking questions. And I always appreciate his posts on these matters. So, Dr. Eli David, thank you so much for joining us today. How are you?
Thank you very much. Great to be here, Alan.
Great. So, tell us from the start, how did things, because obviously in Israel, people may not know it, but the tech, biomedicine, there's a range of areas that are very advanced. But what first got you concerned in terms of the response to the situation with COVID? Just bring us into your world and what was going on when it first started and how you started asking questions about it, if you would.
Certainly. I vividly remember the beginning of 2020. We all heard about this deadly once in a century pandemic coming out of China. And initially, I was as concerned and as, I must admit, panicked as everyone else was. I remember in early March 2020, I was moving around with a big N95 mask on my face everywhere. I was concerned, just looking at the data, you know, looking at those videos of people collapsing in China. By the way, we never saw that in the Western world. I wonder why. But late in March 2020 and early in April, there was a series of papers by John Ioannidis, Professor John Ioannidis, the most cited physician in the world. He's from Stanford, a physician, epidemiologist, statistician. His papers are cited millions of times all over. So, and he's a guy that cares only about data, and he's the face of modern evidence-based medicine. He published a series of papers, and I vividly remember the first one of them. Its conclusion was that the COVID infection fatality rate was much higher than regular flu for those over 70 years old, the same as the flu for those between 70 and 30 years old, and much lower than regular flu for the young people. So the moment I saw that, and again, another paper shortly afterwards, and more evidence accumulating, then I said, what is this whole thing about? The data doesn't support this panic. And that was the moment for me to say, I took the red pill, and I saw what's happening. And since then, I've been very vocal about that.
It's a very important piece of research and ongoing research that you mentioned, that you referenced, John Ioannidis. We've just seen in the last few weeks with the Twitter files and the lockdown files in the United Kingdom with the Telegraph newspaper, how there was a concerted effort to suppress questions, alternative views, challenges, reflections about lockdowns, social distancing, masks, particularly about COVID-19 vaccines. Just first off, from someone who's obviously passionate and very good at science and maths and data, how does all that strike you when debate is suffocated and restricted?
COVID set back the state of science by decades, maybe even a century. For the better part of 20th century, scientists in all disciplines, including medical sciences, were constantly educated and encouraged to promote and follow evidence-based science, evidence-based medicine. You know, there's a famous quote of Richard Feynman, the physicist, Nobel laureate, and he said, if the evidence contradicts your theory is wrong. That's the end to it. And what happened during COVID, we saw the exact opposite of that. If the evidence contradicts your theory, the evidence is wrong. You're a conspiracy theorist. You're spreading misinformation. We saw that in Israel, unfortunately, even I think worse than you witnessed in the UK. And it was, the situation was terrible for scientists in the UK. In Israel, it was even worse. It was as a kind of, we're fighting this war against this once in a century pandemic. And any scientist who is dissenting and providing other information, he is just betraying this war. It was scientists and physicians, some of the leading physicians in Israel, immunologists, those who were founders of the largest hospital in Israel, they were all treated like traitors in a war. That is how we all felt.
Now, why, can I ask you, because for many will know, but some are not familiar, I mean, Israel is much more a state that is a military state. People have national service and conscription. You have mandatory identification there. Everyone accepts it. We have some different circumstances. It's because of its history and its situation. It's largely accepted that it's a military state. People have different views about it, but it is what it is. That warlike approach, we did see it here as well. Every evening, press conferences with the press very few of them asking any alternative questions. But how, what, when you first started discussing this with your peers and your colleagues, just talk us through how this all developed. What were their responses? Did some people say things privately? What happened when people tried to speak out? What was the situation? What was the climate?
There were initially, even in private conversations, most of my friends and scientists and physician colleagues, they really believed that government propaganda. They really believed that people such as myself, we are causing great harm by speaking publicly about this. That has changed, but it was a very gradual process. It took some time, and more people started seeing that the evidence that is presented doesn't add up. But even those that saw the reality, saw that the evidence is wrong, saw that the government is spreading misinformation, until very late, most of them, even until now, did not have the courage to speak up, to speak in public, and for very good reasons. Any scientist or physician who spoke, he was fired. He was, you know, there was a revelation last week that that all the major news, the media sources, the TVs, the newspapers, got direct orders from their editors to not interview anyone who is a skeptic, lockdown skeptic, vaccine skeptic, mask skeptic, not to interview them. And there is speculation as to what was the reasons. One of the reasons that are suggested and sounds very believable is that the Minister of Health back then spent huge amounts of money advertising in all the media, all the advertisements about lockdown, stay home, stay safe, and all that nonsense. And that was a huge source of revenue for all the media sources. And the threat was that if you do interview or if you do quote those sources that are have dissenting opinions, we simply will not advertise with you and will simply kill one of your major sources of revenue. So that's what happened with the media. But I actually think the worst part about Israel was that the right-wing government, the conservatives here, completely got it wrong. In every Western country, and I'm talking all about Western countries, the left, the liberal left, the woke left, they were all the same. The left in the US, in the UK, in France, in everywhere, they behaved exactly the same. Follow the science, mask up, double mask, get your fifth booster, etc. But the right wing in different countries behaved differently. Even in those countries in which the right wing made many mistakes, like Trump originally made lots of mistakes, Boris Johnson originally was about to get it right and then did a 180-degree change and got it wrong. But even if the leaders got it wrong, a good portion of the members of the party, members of the parliament in your case, or members of Senate and Congress, Republicans in the U.S., from the very beginning, they thought this is wrong. In Israel, on the other hand, the left was pro the narrative. The right was even more pro the narrative. Now, our prime minister back then, Benjamin Netanyahu, was quoted in a cabinet meeting saying that this virus may very well be the end of humanity. This was the kind of panic that even the right wing spread. So we were the only Western country in which, when our parliament passed the COVID mandate, the COVID passports, nobody opposed it. Not from the left, not from the right, not the so-called independents. In no other parliament in the Western world this happened. So in Israel, anyone who had dissenting views, such as myself, we were in more than other countries, we were in a uniquely disadvantageous position and being attacked by everyone across the spectrum.
So there's a lot there, but they do say that the first casualty of war is often the truth. And being on a warlike footing, on the one hand, you can see why people might want to do it, get everyone behind things. But certainly when they tried to rally people in Britain at first, like you say, Boris Johnson did at first hold the line, could have done a bit more, a bit like Sweden, but he caved in. But there were nearly a million volunteers in the United Kingdom who were ready to get involved and do things and participate. And it was all squandered, and we were told to be locked away. And it was like this contempt for the public. But I wonder, Ellie, to what extent you think, is it that you think it's simply about money and, you know, big companies with a lot of money and lobbying? Because except for Sweden and perhaps, you know, later on Florida and Texas and a couple of other outliers, almost all, as you say, did go down this road. Or, you know, what would you put it down to, this kind of everyone going in the same similar direction, throwing away pandemic strategies, silencing critics? Do you think it's to do with weak authoritarians? Do you think there's something more sinister? Do you think it's a mixture of things? How do you see it, just before we go to the break?
I don't think there is a single cause of that. It's a combination of them. The Hanlon's razor states never attribute to malice what can adequately be explained by incompetence. So I think there was lots of incompetence here, but it was not just that. It was more than that. There was some bad intentions. There were lots of greed. There were lots of corruption. In the governments that promoted it, there was a combination of incompetence by government health officials and lots of officials that suddenly see power in their hands. And when you can grab power, you don't relinquish it easily. But for me, the most disappointing part was not that the government was misusing its power. It's, as a libertarian, that's my assumption. The government will always misuse its power. For me, the biggest disappointment was actually the public, the people, the citizens. The vast majority of them just trusted the experts and followed the science, the trademark science. When they were told to be afraid of something, they all became afraid of that. When they told to do something to prevent, to protect against a source of fear, they all did that. And when people pointed their fingers and the dissenting voices and said, these are the enemies, they all pointed the fingers and said, yes, you are the enemies. So that was for me the most disappointing part in that. Now, there's also a good part. I'm trying to be optimistic. For me, the optimistic part is that most of those people in the public that now I speak to varying degrees, they do agree that they were fooled. In Israel, only a very small fraction of people got their fourth shot, the second booster. Almost nobody got the fifth shot. So people start, even though the Ministry of Health started pushing that, you must get the fifth shot, otherwise children can die, the young, healthy people can die, etc. People just stopped believing them. So for me, the good part, the optimistic part about that is that next time the government tell us to do something, I believe and I hope that people will be more skeptical of that. Maybe that's just my naive one.
Well, we're going to come back to that just after the break. I'm Alan Miller. I'm here with Dr. Ellie David. This is TNT Radio. Join us after the break.
TNT Radio's Charlie Robinson.
$880 billion was the number I saw. Now, San Francisco can't make their rent, okay? They're bankrupt. The entire city is bankrupt. But yeah, let's carve out almost $1 trillion to pay people that weren't slaves money in a state that didn't have slaves from a bunch of people that, I don't know, never really even owned slaves either. So it seems like a really dumb idea. North Carolina, though, where you guys are, that was actually a slave area. Where are your reparations?
There's no speak of reparation right here. Now, of course, I don't want them. All right. I do not want them.
I know you don't.
Look, yeah. The simple fact of reparations is ridiculous because the people who may have needed them have been long gone. I mean, they haven't been on this planet for a while now. So it makes no sense at all, reparations at this point in time. And then plus, with the way our currency is currently, as far as devaluing the dollar, I mean, yeah, just go ahead and drop $800 billion, you know, into the marketplace with no product behind it, and I'm pretty sure nothing will skyrocket in price. Right, Charlie? Nothing to go
right,
up.
Yeah.
Charlie Robinson on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Have you ever felt like time was moving too fast? Do you need a break from the hustle and bustle of your daily routine? Then come and experience Sam Yao Noi, where time slows down and magic comes to life on the stunning Yao Noi Island in southern Thailand. Our private villas and public spaces are quiet, spacious, and very inspirational. Inside and outside magic spaces, you'll find exceptional facilities and a full contemporary art collection to inspire your senses. Our dedicated SamSam family is here to provide bespoke services to make your stay unforgettable. Let nature and our SamSam family team take over, and you'll get the utmost recalibration of your mental balance. Discover the enchantment that awaits you at SamSam Yanoi. Book your stay today at SamSam Yanoi and experience our magic places, magic spaces for yourself.
Book your stay in Thailand now and visit samsam-spaces.com.
Adopt US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting. A teenager, learning the lingo.
Today I'm going to help parents translate teen slang. Now, when a teen says something is on fleek, it's exactly like saying, that's rad. It simply means that something is awesome or cool. Another one is totes. It's exactly like saying, totally, just shorter. As in, I totes love going to the mall with Becca. Another word you might hear is jelly. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous, as in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will think you're, rad, just the same. To learn more, visit AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
If you're still wearing a cloth or surgical mask around in public, you're guilty of spreading COVID misinformation. It really is that simple. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back, everyone. We're just in the midst of this, and it's quite a harrowing discussion, actually, with Dr. Ellie David, because one thing I've got to ask you, Ellie, is that lots of people say lots of things about Israel. I visited you there. I happen to know a little bit about the history and the people. And I've always thought that regardless of what they say across the world, within Israel, there's this sense that they want to protect their own citizens. Now, I know different people have different interests in your point about being a libertarian, but there's also a very, very strong scientific community and very strong biomedical community and mathematicians, physics. I know there's a strong military role, and that can sometimes have a very particular relationship with other things like pharma and others. And I know with conversations with Dr. Robert Malone and others that they're concerned about those things. But this sense in which so much of the idea of the science, you said that you were concerned that that citizens didn't ask more questions. But often, if you're not a scientist, it's difficult, right? And I want to come back to this because there is a concern also that now some people aren't taking any vaccinations. And I want to ask you what you think about that. But just to try and drill down a bit more, do you still think the idea of, I take your point about being a libertarian, but about in your own country, that the people, generally, there's a sense that the people who are elected are trying to do best efforts with difficult information, because for so many people that were so well versed in data and science, it just seems strange that they could carry on saying things that you've described, particularly around vaccinating children.
Now, I do believe, based on many of my conversations with leading politicians here, with the right-wing politicians, that they truly believe they were doing the right thing. I spoke to many of them, and none of them gave me any reason to doubt their intentions. They were fooled. They were fooled by government scientists, by the Ministry of Health. When you are a politician, you're not a scientist. You're not a physician. And the top government Ministry of Health officials tell you this is the end of the world pandemic, tell you that little children may die if they don't take the vaccine. What would you do? I'm not sure if I were in their shoes without my scientific background, I wouldn't have done differently. And this happened everywhere. In the UK, the kind of models that Professor Ferguson posted, they were just ridiculous. But I know that they're ridiculous. Any scientist that looks through them knows it's ridiculous. Do you expect government officials to know that? Same in the US. Fauci just fooled everyone, Fauci and Birx. So a little reason to doubt their motivation. They were trying to do the good thing, but I have lots of criticism, of course, on them for not actively seeking dissenting opinions. When people such as myself and senior other scientists try to approach them, they shut us down. They didn't even hear us. And the way they forced their opinions on people. Even when you're absolutely correct that something is the right thing, there is no way you can force it on people. You know, when the first vaccine came out, the original, at the beginning, the Pfizer vaccine, I looked at the evidence, the published paper, which showed it was effective. I didn't have any reason to doubt that. It's a published paper. I look at the data. It makes sense. I spoke to two of the leading immunologists in Israel. They both were pro the vaccine. So I took the first two shots. But even back then, I was appalled that people are being forced and coerced into taking that. Then more evidence emerged. And in retrospect, I must admit, I was a fool. I trusted that data. The data was biased. The data was wrong. And of course, I didn't get any of the boosters. But even if you're a scientist, you must doubt that what you believe today may end up being wrong tomorrow. And even more so if you're a politician or a leader.
So let's look at this a bit more. You work in the world of mathematics, AI, science. You understand these things, data, looking at peer-reviewed studies. We, as you say, you had no reason to doubt it because it seemed like it was, you know, published material. They've done the due diligence. But we then discover that AstraZeneca and also Pfizer and others, with the redactions, we've seen that who the tests were, how the tests were done, what some of the impacts could be, the fact that it did not want to be released and you had to have court cases to do it. And still, there's a conversation about, you know, who it, was it still of merit for some people who are very vulnerable. I just on this point, even people that were laymen here would say to me, you can't tell me that the government hasn't worked out, this is right at the start, that the most vulnerable people are the over 70s and 80s with underlying conditions. People know that from the get-go. They knew that. And I suppose my question is, what do you think happened? Why do you think it was that big international organizations, and we were told we're keeping you safe in Britain, follow the science. Why do you think there's been so much attempt to limit access to this data? Why haven't they just gone, look, it's very good for everyone. We know there's some side effects like with all medicine, but the cost-benefit analysis, it's decent. Here's all the studies, here's all the reports. Why is there an attempt not to have these discussions out, in your view?
Self-interest. Simple. At the big pharma side, they have no interest in allowing this data to be released because we will see the biases that they have. Now, we with quite high confidence can guess that even the original data in the original Pfizer paper that convinced people such as myself to get vaccinated, we know that even there were biases. We don't know the extent of that. The raw data was never published. Even until this day, nearly 3 years afterwards, we still don't have access to the agreement the Israeli government signed with Pfizer. The court ordered the government to publish that with some redactions, and they published it. Most of the document was redacted. There were pages and pages and pages that there was not a single English word in them. They were just redacted. So to this day, we don't have any idea what happened there, but all the efforts of going into hiding that, we can guess there are good reasons for them trying to hide it. So for the big pharma, it is protecting their revenue back then, and now protecting themselves against lawsuits and damages. And we know that all those big names have paid billions and billions of damages in the past years. Naturally, they're not inclined to pay more now. And for government, they told everyone it's safe and effective. We now know that it is unsafe and ineffective. So do you really expect them to help us to publish the data that will prove of their incompetence or even worse than that? There is no interest for anyone to do that. The only hope is that you will see a complete shift in power in government. For example, if next time in the next elections, the Republicans control the entire U.S., the White House, the Senate, the Congress, and then you will start seeing documents being released because they will no longer have all the interest to hide them. in countries such as Israel that there is a more or less continuity of the government since the COVID era. In the UK, the same, more or less the continuity and the same civil servants and government officials. I don't think we will see the true data and the true protocols behind them.
I wonder, just moving forwards, I mean, you know, I want to talk about some of your work that you do, but how is it in Israel? Because in Britain, many young parents and others now are not giving other vaccinations to their children. There's a level of distrust. In truth, there was a level of distrust to big pharma and to medicine and to politicians and the media before COVID, but now it's really, in some areas, ruptured. And that there's all sorts of things like measles, mumps and rubella and a range of different things. We know in the past the discussions about Dr. Andrew Wakefield and the discussion about autism, and it was disproved. But what's it like there? Do you have concerns about the impact to the knowledge and the benefits we do have from innovation and from health and science? How do you see it?
In Israel now, we're witnessing the biggest drop in routine children vaccination in history. You know, two of my good friends are senior pediatricians in two of the largest children's hospitals in Israel, and they're saying firsthand this, they have never seen such a sharp drop in routine vaccinations. And that could end up being tragic, but that's not surprising. Both of these friends of mine, by the way, give me the credit that already 2 years ago I said this would happen. Back then I told them, Ministry of Health, the government officials, they are labeling any dissenting voice as anti-vaxxer. And these include some of the leading scientists in Israel, immunologists, physicians, vaccine experts, epidemiologists, Nobel laureates, all founders of largest hospitals in Israel. They are all being labeled the anti-vaxxers. The most famous case was Professor Shmuel Shapira. He was for over 10 years the head of Israel Biological Institute. He's the highest ranking government official. You can, like, more or less the head of DARPA in Israeli terms. And he himself fully vaxxed. He started criticizing the vaccine, that the myocarditis, the blood clots, etc. And Minister of Health, the official Twitter account of Minister of Health, started attacking him, disparaging him day in and day out and calling him an anti-vaxxer. Now, imagine a random parent, and he's seeing that the top scientists and physicians in Israel, they're all anti-vaxxers. So what do they think about vaccines? So, well, maybe we should postpone a bit the vaccination of our children. When you associate the top scientists and physicians in the country with the label anti-vaxxer, the end result will be drop in vaccination rate. And sadly, that is exactly what we're witnessing.
Yeah. I want to move it on a little bit to, there's a few things, but what I'm fascinated by your area of professional interest, and people should know that you're the developer of Falcon, which was a grandmaster level chess playing program based on genetic algorithms and deep learning, which actually got second place in the World Computer Chess Championship. There's a lot of concern. I would say some of the fear that's linked to some of the fear about the environment and COVID, and this kind of almost like doom laden, panic stricken, particularly now with AI, the sense that it's going to be like Terminator or Black Mirror, out of control. It's a bit like Frankenstein. Just tell us what you actually do in your professional area, and do you think that the concerns are as significant as some are saying?
Well, my field of research within AI is an area called artificial neural networks. Just like our brain has real neural networks and that's what makes us intelligent, the area is about researching the artificial version of that. Now, when I started 25 years ago, this was considered an almost refuted field of study within AI. We could train just small neural networks, a few thousand or tens of thousands of parameters. But thankfully, luckily for me, my field of research turned into now the center of AI and all the big models you see, ChatGPT, image generations, they're all based on artificial neural networks. we just managed to train bigger and bigger models with millions, billions, and very soon trillions of parameters, almost the size of computation capability of our own brains. The results are nothing short of breathtaking. And some people say, oh, this is an AI hype. I absolutely don't think this is an AI hype, because we are not excited about things AI may do in the future. We're excited about things AI is already doing right now. Just to give you an example from last week, I had to send the lengthy email to the students in my university course. I didn't have time to write it in many pages, so I just wrote two sentences and asked ChatGPT to turn it into a professional-looking long document for me to send them. I did that. I copy-pasted it and sent it. 2 minutes later, I get a question from one of the students. And I read the question, actually a very good question. But how did he read that five-page document in 2 minutes? He happens to be my PhD student. So I just pick up a phone and called him. I said, hey, how did you just read it in 2 minutes? He said, I took your five-page, I just copy-pasted it to ChatGPT and told it to give it to me in two sentences. So that was enough for me to realize long-form text will be gone. Many things will be gone. Many things would change. Many professions will be revolutionized. Now, lots of good things will come out of that, no doubt. I am most excited about its potential for healthcare. I have ongoing collaborations with hospitals in Israel, and we see even in emergency care in ICU context, ChatGPT is sometimes diagnosing faster and more with higher accuracy than best human experts. Countless lives will be saved thanks to this. Early diagnosis will be made. Better diagnosis and treatment will be made. So AI will do lots and lots of good to the world. But similar to every technology invented since the dawn of humanity, there are lots of risks involved. And the main risk is that we cannot accurately predict the risk. We cannot define it to be able to predict it. Now, when people ask me, again, look at the AI as an exponentially growing thing. Not today's AI, but next year's AI will be 10 times smarter, 10 times bigger brain. In 2 years, it will be 100 or 1,000 times smarter than us. So there is little doubt in a matter of next few years, not even decade, next few years, we will have AI that is superhuman, has superhuman intelligence, orders of magnitude more intelligent than us. I think there's little doubt in that. The question I'm being asked is, what will that AI do? Will it try to serve us, or will it try to kill us? And my answer is that not only I don't know, there is no way to know that. Imagine you ask a chimpanzee, what would humans do? The chimpanzee will not be able to predict. And the only difference between our brain and that of chimpanzees is that our brain is a bit larger. That's all. No other difference. Under a microscope, it looks the same. So if a lesser brain cannot predict the risks and benefits of a bigger brain, then we are exactly in the same situation. So I'm very optimistic about the potentials, and I'm indeed very worried as well.
On that note, we're going to go to a quick break. I'm Alan Meadow. I'm here with Dr. Ellie David. Join us just after this. This is TNT Radio.
De-weaponizing weather with reality and perspective.
I'm in Newark, New Jersey right now. I'm here to watch a wrestling tournament tomorrow. And the reason I'm telling you that is twofold. One, when I was a kid, people used to say, and I didn't agree with this, that Newark was the armpit of the world. I don't agree with that for a second. And of course, one of the things we have to remember is the armpit is an essential body part. But the reason I'm bringing this up is, Scott, it doesn't look too bad around here. Visibility's around 10 miles. Looks like the smoke is gone. I wonder if the climate change somehow has gotten rid of all the smoke. Of course, I am being facetious. Maybe one of you can write TNT and give me a definition of that word. It has more than two syllables, and everybody knows that I'm a Neanderthal because of my climate change position. But the fact is, the smoke is clearing out of the northeast part of the United States. and much of the United States is cooler than normal. It's going to get mighty, mighty hot in Texas. I know that comes as a shock to you that it's going to get hot in Texas during summer. And guess what? There's going to be severe weather this weekend in the southern part of the United States. So you see, that's the glory of the climate change situation. You can get rid of the wildfire smoke, but all we got to do is run to Texas and severe weather, and we can blame climate change again. This is TNT Climate and Weather Watchdog meteorologist Joe Bastardi asking you to enjoy the weather. It's the only weather you got.
Engine 2, respond emergency, structure fire. Address is somewhere in the downtown region. House in question is medium-ish in size. It's a stucco house, a mostly stucco house, and it's kind of near a parking lot. Over.
If we can't find you, we can't help you. If you call 911 from a cell phone, please be prepared to give us your exact location. Visit ecom911.ca to learn more. Ecom 911. Help us help.
It's time to switch on
today's news talk radio.
Very entertaining.
Yeah. TNT.
It was fascinating. I'm here with Dr. Ellie David. I know we're not going to have enough time anywhere near to scratch the surfaces even, but Ellie, as well as being an ongoing critical voice on social media, he's both a CTO and a founder of a number of organizations to do with AI, Deep Instinct, Nano Dimension, and with health service and provision using AI within it. I suppose my question is, on the one hand, your point about intelligence, I think sometimes people talk about intelligence, there's a difference between processing, and obviously AI can process things much quicker and it will continue to do that. And then the question of the kinds of choices and independent curative thought that are made, the cognitive leaps or the way that we can understand and inform and impose ourselves on the world. And I think that's still limited. If you look at robots and AI, you can't still get a robot to come into the house, make a cup of tea and bring it up the stairs to you. Those things are still limited. Now, they might leapfrog ahead, but we do have a sense that things are outside, out of our control. The question is, how do we control the concerns that you've raised? Like with digital ID, you know, in Israel, the green card, that was a big part of, they were front leaders. But as I say, you do have IDs already in Israel. In many other countries, they don't. But how would you see? I think your point about the public is very important. It's really up to the public to insist on privacy and non-surveillance and many of the things. I think that perhaps that some of the things that people are okay with in Israel, like, you know, facial technology recognition and things like that. But tell me if I'm wrong. But certainly in Britain, we've got a lot of concerns about constant surveillance, about monitoring, but we, you know, it's definitely a great idea in terms of health and your doctors and others having your records. So how do you think it's best to keep that honest and keep that privacy and autonomy while still getting the best benefits from technology?
Let me share with you the results of a poll I did on Twitter about AI. You will find the results funny. But do you think AI should be regulated? 73% say yes, as expected. Now, who should regulate AI? 90% say government, 28% say industry, 53% say nobody. And do you trust the government to regulate AI? 97% say no. So essentially people that believe that AI should be regulated, but nobody should regulate it, and certainly not the government. And I fully agree with this. We should put some limits to use of AI, but definitely not by government. COVID, if we needed another reason, COVID proved to us that government cannot be trusted with almost anything. So it is up to us, the citizens, the public, to decide what is acceptable for us and what is not. And certainly not follow the scientists, follow the government, follow the WEF or follow anyone into telling us this is for your own good or this is not. We need to encourage and educate people to have independent thoughts, and it is okay if people think differently. If I feel comfortable giving my genetic sequencing information to some provider, and if I feel comfortable for external AI to process it, that is fine, as long as it is my decision. if you think it is not okay, nobody should coerce you or force you or give you false incentives to do that. And that is what we need. And that's, I think, the only way that we can make sure, or at least increase the probability that AI will serve us and not endanger us, or even worse, enslave us even more than we were during the COVID time, the government and the expert tyranny.
One of the things that did happen during COVID was that we did see images of people challenging in Israel on some of the streets, people that were challenging some of the measures, like people in Italy and France and Melbourne and certainly in Britain in some places, different sizes, but there was particularly in the later stages. So there were challenges to those things. And we have seen things like the young people that were doing the tents and the camping about house prices in Israel. And they were huge. And then we've seen more recently some other protests about measures that the government are doing in the territories. I wonder, just because you may have different views about all those three things, but just how much do you think some of those things did have an impact in Israel? Some of the stuff that citizens are doing, with the world looking or not, even with the limits on the media coverage and everything. What's your view about it?
Currently, as you know, there's lots of weekly protests against the proposed judiciary reform. It's against them. It's nothing to do with the territories. It's all against the government proposed judicial reform. And I think everyone agrees that the reforms are needed. The question is to what extent and to what side. But anyway, you know, a good friend of mine a few days ago asked me why I am not coming to any of these protests against the judicial reform. And he said, our civil rights, our civil liberties may be jeopardized if the judicial reform is passed as it is. And I ask him, well, I'm happy that you're concerned about that. You're concerned about civil liberties that may be jeopardized in the future. Where were you when the civil liberties were jeopardized during COVID? When people were just stripped of their basic civil rights because they didn't take the booster? Israel, by the way, was the only country and the first, and I think the only country, that you were essentially kept out of everywhere, not because you were unvaccinated, because you didn't take your booster. So I do appreciate people who are protesting for civil liberties, but I am both skeptical and have quite a high degree of cynicism towards them, because when the civil liberties of people were trampled upon here, almost nobody protested. So I do take all of these protests now with a huge amount of salt.
Moving forwards, in terms of the lessons that are learned both amongst your colleagues and peers and new discussions, I mean, I appreciate that Israel has some very particular ongoing concerns that up until recently perhaps we didn't have as much in certain countries. I know there's obviously Ukraine and Russia, and there's obviously been Iraq and Libya, but for many people, although some of their sons are there, it's not as immediate for all the nation. But in terms of this kind of thing, we get discussions about the environment, new viruses. We know that the World Health Organization is talking about amendments and the treaty reorganizing. How much do you think this climate of emergency? I noticed your post about Greta's "we're about to all go" post that you just made recently. But how much is your concern about this permanent state of emergency and crisis that we're in, and what we can actually do about that?
Now, what the government knew, but all the governments learned even more during COVID, that you can push your agenda using fear. Fear is one of the greatest tools. Fear, emergency, climate crisis. Everything is now a crisis. Every new virus will be a pandemic. And they will try that to push their agenda. The World Health Organization announced this week, that the adoption of the European vaccine passport and to use it for entire healthcare, medical records, pandemics, And the WHO director mentioned the other things like the climate crisis and other stuff. I come to think of that the COVID passport wasn't invented because of COVID, but actually COVID was invented. I'm saying it a bit cynically, yes, that COVID was not invented, was used to promote all these health passports and further controls. And the same with all the ideas suggested for carbon passports and carbon quotas. And the funny thing is that those people who promote that, they are flying in private jets in a single flight of, let's say, Bill Gates or the climate envoy John Kerry. In a single flight in private jet, they emit more carbon than our cars in our entire lifetimes. But they do that, and they promote this carbon agenda. So I don't think even they themselves believe in their own nonsense and the figures that they're quoting. But they are using it to promote fear. And on one hand, there is fear, and on the other hand, you have all these academics and scientists and that want to be on the right side of science because they get better promotion, better grants. So there is little interest for anyone except Twitter trolls such as you and me to oppose them, to point out their hypocrisy.
One thing I'm interested, we're coming to the end of the hour and we'd definitely love to get you back for some more soon, but we've seen recently interesting moves like America and Israel, like America and Britain had what they call a special relationship for a long time. Things are changing in America and Israel and everywhere, but certainly with China now and India and Russia, there's different, you know, it's no longer the case, it's just America now. Certainly China's on the world stage. It's forming alliances, organizing, brought recently Iran and Saudi Arabia together. Certainly Israel's got new alliances again in the Gulf states. We're seeing everything seems to be changing. And also I'm sure Israel's consideration geopolitically in all of that. How do you just see that out of interest, just from your point of view?
I think similar to other topics we discussed, even in economic consideration, geopolitical considerations. I always try not to automatically follow the narrative, even in the areas that are not my expertise. So, for example, the geopolitics, definitely not my expertise. But I'm cautious of following the narrative that these are the good guys, these are the bad guys, this is okay, this is not okay. I think we all found out that the world is a bit more complicated than that. So, yes, countries that did not have an alliance, they do have alliance, and vice versa, because interests change. And I don't think that is substantially wrong. We can look at the Middle East, thanks to Trump administration's effort, thanks to specifically Jared Kushner's effort. He got lots of criticism. But that guy managed to bring more peace agreements in Middle East than all previous U.S. administrations combined. So times change, interests change. And by the way, these new peace agreements in Middle East, they're actually not cold pieces, they're warm pieces. People from Dubai and Tel Aviv fly back and forth constantly. There are many economic collaborations, ventures together. So times are changing, and this is not necessarily for the bad. There are many good things that are coming out of that.
Yeah. So just tell us if people want, I mean, you've got so many followers already, but if people do want to follow you, where can they do that? And then if you would leave us with just one thought or reflection from your current experience and as we move forward to the future, what would it be?
First of all, I would be happy for anyone who would like to follow me on Twitter and LinkedIn. Both of them are same handle, Dr. Eli David. On LinkedIn, it's solely professional AI related. On Twitter, it's AI and lots of trolling on every subject. And my last thought, what I constantly tell myself, and I think the most important value that I try to teach my children, is be skeptical. Ask for yourself. Don't take anything as at face value. There is the Royal Society in the UK is one of the oldest scientific societies in the world. Their motto is nullius in verba. It's Latin for don't take their word for it. Always prefer evidence. And I think that's the most important lesson for us for any subject, any aspect of our life. Never take anyone's words in contrast to the evidence.
Fantastic. Well, be skeptical. Use our consciousness to challenge things. I'm Alan Miller. That was Dr. Ellie or Eli, depending on where you are in the world. David, thanks so much for joining us today. We're going to be back after the news. Please join us. I'm going to have Dr. Tara McCormack and also Anne Roberts from Edinburgh, campaigner about traffic measures and mobility. It's a big shout going out to all the people challenging in Dartford right now, challenging you, Liz, and Sadiq Khan's mad policy. We'll see you after the news. Stay free. It's the TNT Radio. I'm Alan Miller.